the enthusiastic and important backgrounds. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty. I wanted you to see something. Why this topic, just in the beginning on page one, we'll go through the whole handout a little. Some things will move faster than others. First thing we should look at over here is this basically is going to explain why this issue never was a big issue. And why that's important is issues that are big issues. Remember we did Mitzitza? We did Mitzitza Bepeh. So there was that historical cycling of the issue. And what that, the good part about that, I mean, it's unfortunate that that's the way life is. We can't seem to settle. We have to keep coming back and forth like a sine wave. But the good news is that when you have that, you have tons of Gedolim looking into the issue. Tons of Achronim exploring Shas, exploring Rishonim for relevant material. This one was off the books, never discussed, never an issue until the 1960s. So that's why there's going to be a dearth. You'll see there's not going to be many Makoros. There'll be some basic Makoros. There'll be one Gemara, one Mishnah, the statements of the Rambam. You're not going to have other Rishonim weighing in, really. And you'll have a few Achronim, and we'll see why contextually those particular Makoros came in. But you'll notice overall, for an issue as significant as this, not much out there. And the reason is what do you think? Before we look inside, you can look inside if you want a hint, but why would you think that this issue was not really one? What issue? Defining the moment of death. That's really where we're going to focus. Let's define the moment of death, and then everything else will come from there. Once we define the moment of death, then we'll see all the nafkaminas and take it from there. Transplants, taking people off respirators, and all that kind of stuff. But why wasn't anyone really caring that much about defining the moment of death?
Death used to be pretty pashut. I mean, before CPR and all those other methods came about, it's someone's not alive, they're not alive, someone's alive, they're alive. It's no great matter, really.
Also, we didn't have...
Great
matter.
It's fine. It's good.
It's
a
great matter.
Excellent.
I meant to say that.
any nafkamina, just let's now think, not like... We pretend none of us have any interest in science or medicine, right? For some of us, that's easier than others, right? So, any nafkamina to the moment of death?
Yeah, transplants.
We don't have any interest in medicine or science. If you talk about transplants, you have interest in medicine.
Yerusha?
Just as you're a Rav.
Yerusha.
You're a Rav living in the 1500s. So what are the nafkaminas for the moment of death? Is Yerusha... as a matter of fact, they did. There you go. It's not taken together, I apologize. But that's okay. I have my own. I want to work a little more over here. So, nafkaminas in halacha, you're saying Yerusha, good. That is one. Meaning what?
I mean,
why is Yerusha?
Well, if the guy's eventually...
When they get to take possession? what's one that's really nafkamina? I'll give you a hint. It's on the first page. Right. Kohen, when do they have to leave the room? Right? Now, maybe it's a masmini, maybe it's not. Rav Shechter is famous when he discusses the topic of Tumas Kohenim. He has a very solid shita where the nafkamina is kind of not so important anymore. Right? The theoretical nafkamina is at the moment of death, the Kohen is going to be in trouble. He's going to be by Ohel with a mace and he's going to be over in an Issa Daraisa. Right? However, Midrabanan, if you look over here, I brought you the siman with this. The Shach already mentions that there's probably this is the Rabbanan even before the moment of death for the Kohen to get out of there. So Lamaisa, even that is not such a big nafkamina. But that was the only sort of setting that this was discussed because it meant something to the Kohen getting out. The one who really stresses this point, I wanted to purposely introduce you to this because I want anyone who's interested in bioethics, as I'm assuming you guys are here for that reason. You know who the father of bioethics is? The one who's considered the original, the first bioethics guy, right? Nowadays we have Rabbi Tendler, we have Rabbi Blyer, Rabbi Reichman, right? Dr. Reichman, right? All these people, Rabbi Steinberg, Avram Sofer Avram, Rabbi Halperin, these are all the names, the who's who. But who was the real first one? Rabbi, I forgot, Dr. Rosner. Right? No, he's... I'm saying specifically bioethics. Like, no one is a bioethics guy. Lord?
Oh.
Chief Rabbi of England, Jacobus. He was the one. He was the one who wrote the first book. The first English literature work on this, on bioethics, was him. And that's where this takes, paragraph number one over there is taken from. And he wrote this in 1959. So that's when it all began. Look what he writes. He said, "Religious literature has devoted much attention to the problem of ascertaining the exact moment of death. In Judaism, however, unlike Christianity, this problem has little or no purely religious significance." So this is writing in 1959, right? That's what I just told you. It really was like, who cares? You know, and mainly because, you know, there wasn't that much need for precision. Basically, when somebody was dead, they were dead. You were right. There's no gray matter, or great matter, whatever you meant to say, right? Person was brain death, they're going to be cardiac death, respiratory death within moments. There wasn't any great separation. However, if you look now, skip the Shulchan Aruch, go down to that new, this is the note to the new edition of Rabbi Jacobowitz's magnum opus on medical ethics. He writes the following. This is in 1975. Right? So, he wrote like a preface to the new edition. And in it, he wanted to highlight what's changed, what's new. So he writes this: "During this period, some striking medical advances have raised altogether new moral problems. Heart transplants, and I would add, he didn't write this, prolonged ICU stays, the widespread use, then he has other things, have aroused fierce debates among professionals and laymen alike." Why have heart transplants done it and ICU stays? Because now it's really important to know, right? Now we got to figure out, is death dictated by the cessation of breathing and circulation, or is death dictated by just the irreversible loss of brain function, despite the fact that the person might still be kept alive, or kept animated, or kept perfused, would be the medical term we would use, by artificial means. Okay? So,
once your brain dies, is there a possibility of
coming back? There are a few reports, but it's usually probably because brain death was done wrong, which is just as important. Because if they're going to do it wrong, then we don't want to rely on it, right? But the truth is, it's an extremely rare event, right? I would never use that. I'm not, go on record, I am not a supporter of, or I do not agree with the brain death definition, right? But I would never use that argument to support my contention that we shouldn't do it, right? Because you're going to see soon, when we say we're worried about pikuach nefesh, right, that we are concerned that somebody might be dead and might die if we do the wrong thing, right? Is that unlimited? Is that like any possibility, right? I'll tell you what I'm talking about. There's a famous tshuva by the Chasam Sofer. It's in this packet somewhere. And the Chasam Sofer is being asked the following question. It seems the Duke of Mecklenburg, who's Mecklenburg? Anyone? Germany. Right? made an edict. His edict, this is in the 1700s. He says, from now on, no one gets buried for 72 hours from the time you declare them dead.
Somebody was buried alive.
Right. So, why? So, because, I guess it was happening a lot to them, they were burying people alive, right?
How do you know?
And, some interesting.
They put a bell in.
Right. What's the famous saying? Right? He's a dead ringer. Do you hear that expression? He's a dead ringer. Comes from this, because they used to put bells inside, right, just in case, you know, it was off.
And did you get back up?
Yeah, it'd be a good thing to do. They also used to leave air holes, you know, for breathing, just in case, right? Anyway, it's hard to imagine, but this was prevalent enough, a problem at that time in Mecklenburg and the surrounding communities, that he made this edict. Now, who's this a problem for?
Jews.
The Jews. We can't let dead bodies lie around for 72 hours. That's incredible. So there was a famous Jew by the name of Moses Mendelssohn, right? Who was a rabbi, right? He was, some people call him, depending on your attitude and your cynicism degree, the first modern Orthodox rabbi, right? Others of us will say, no, he's not a modern Orthodox rabbi. Whatever. But he went along with it. He went along with this. He said, no, the Jews, he wrote a tshuva. And in the tshuva, he says, the Jews should do this too. And what was his raya? He cited the following Gemara. It's from the Masechta Smachos, right? Any of you heard of that Masechta? It's one of the Masechta Ketanos. It's a not part of Shas, right? But there's a whole bunch of other little Masechtos. And in it, what's Smachos about? What is always Smachos euphemistically used? Simcha? For Avelos, Smachos Avelos, and things like that, right? So in this, it describes the story of an individual who was buried, and they were walking by, and either they heard him screaming or rustling or whatever it was. And he lived for another 25, this is what the Gemara ends. He lived for another 25 years, and he had many, many children. So he says, Araya, Pikuach Nefesh, Mishum Pikuach Nefesh, that's going to be Docha the Isser, and the Chiyav to the Kfura, the Isser of Bizayon to the Mace, and we're going to listen to the Duke of Mecklenburg. That was his truth. So what does the Chasam Sofer write back? He writes back, that's absurd. That's absurd. You're going to tell me, how often does that happen? That a guy who's buried comes back to life. So he says, maybe once in 1,000 years. That's the expression he uses. And there's a limit even to Pikuach Nefesh. Pikuach Nefesh doesn't go that far, right? So if the suffix is so small, 1 in 1,000 years, so that's why I would say that that argument, to get back to your question, that's why that argument, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Harry.
That's why, Harry, that argument is not going to be a good one to use in this discussion, that, you know, once in, I don't know how often, once in every 20 years, once in every 10 years, there's a story, you know, about some guy that was declared brain dead and then comes back. It's not going to be something we have to worry about la halacha, even if it's true. So that would never hold up against the guys that say he's brain dead.
Clearly, it wasn't every 1,000 years or every close to that.
No, the Jews had probably a better approach to declaring people dead. So for the Duke of Mecklenburg and whatever they were doing, he had to make that rule. But the Jews, as the Chasam Sofer will point out further in that treatment, we'll see, had much more care when they did it, right? How did the Jew declare death? Basically, at that time, respiratory death would be certainly everything death in those days. There was no respirators, there was no way of keeping people artificially ventilated. So as soon as you're not breathing, how much time do you have? It depends on body temperature and all these other variables, right? That's why people in icy rivers are going to live longer and all that kind of thing, right? You know those drowning stories? They're really true. A drowning person in an icy, you know, broke through the ice on the lake and then he's drowning, actually can survive longer, right? Without oxygen than a person who's in a warm weather. The metabolic demands of the body are much, much less. You got a little more time. Not much more time. Not like these stories about 9 hours and all that kind of stuff. But
in a way, that's like bad. I mean, if you're underwater and you can't get any oxygen,
you'd rather get
over.
I would want to be over there, yeah. Right? Well, it makes a difference if your friends are there trying to save you.
But if you're on ice fishing by yourself, right? Yeah, don't do that, kid.
Right. Definitely stay off the lakes unless you know guaranteed that it's at least 2 feet thick. Whatever.
And very, very cold.
Right. But anyway, getting back to the topic. So, in truth, there's like a minute or two at most, that it'll be respiratory death followed by cardiac death and brain death in the middle of it all. So, no nafkamina is once they show definitively the person's not breathing, in the days of the Chasam Sofer, that's all they needed. So they would either use a mirror or a feather for a very sensitive indication if the person's breathing, and then there would have to be a period of waiting and prove it again, and of course they're making sure that he's not moving in any other way. We'll see that Chasam Sofer. That would be it. And then it would be once in 1,000 years. If you did things right, the Chasam Sofer writes. And I don't know what the Duke of Mecklenburg's guys were doing. You know, for all I know, they were just taking people and they weren't moving, so they threw them into the, you know.
Did they have like the roof on the
tests?
No, back then they didn't. They didn't do what we're gonna be seeing we do. Alright. So if you look on page 2, so on page 2 is, again, taken from Rabbi Lord Jacobowitz's book. So here he gets into this discussion of the definition of death and resuscitation. And he says, but lately the problem has been rendered both more difficult and more critically acute by the advance in resuscitation techniques and by the demand for viable cadaver organs for transplant purposes. The rule remains firmly fixed to the extent that Jewish law cannot accept the concept of clinical death. So long as there's any spontaneous life action by the heart or lung that persists, even irreversible brain damage or a flat EEG does not legally establish death. Now, this is written in 1975. Jacobowitz is saying, we're not going to count brain death. But why is this not? This has no relevance to us. Why? What was the definition of brain death then? It was much, much, much lighter than it is today. Meaning, like, let's start with flat EEG. Who knows what an EEG is? An electroencephalogram, which is what?
Do
you ever? Yes, it's exactly what it does. And if you ever see the setup, it's these million electrodes. It looks pretty gruesome, right? All these electrodes, you know, 50 electrodes glued into the head, right? And it's measuring the electrical activity of the brain. Now, let's say someone has a flat electroencephalogram. Does that in any way mean they're dead or even brain dead? Absolutely not. What kind of things could you do a flat EEG? Drug overdose, coma, because it's really only getting the surface stimuli. I was going to say, I have a few more to add, right? Definitely TV, too many video games, all that kind of stuff, right? Give you flat EEG. So that certainly was not reliable. That was kind of things they were doing back then. Now we've gotten more sophisticated. So it could be that Rabbi Jacobowitz would feel differently. So we're going to see in a moment exactly how we do it. Turn to page 3. This is what I told you about the other day. I just wanted you to see this. This is the comeback for heart transplants dated in 1982. Here's where things really, really took off. This issue became hot and everybody started going after a definition in 1982 because that's when that cyclosporin came in and now transplants were viable. We weren't killing everybody who we took the heart from and gave the heart to. Now the people getting the hearts were living. It was just the question, are we killing the people we're taking the heart from? So if you turn the page, what we're going to start with now is what I started doing the other day, and I was defining for you how brain death is declared. And I told you basically there are two functions to the brain. There's the function of the cerebral cortex and there's the function of the brainstem. Right? So you don't need to read this article now, but this is a whole description of declaring someone brain death. And what I'd like you to really see is the next page, very quickly. We need a little elementary understanding. This stuff you know, it's all reviewed from the other day. There's the brain, right? There's the cerebellum. What does the cerebellum do, anyone know? Very good, good, balance. And the brainstem. Brainstem has, I told you so far one thing it does. What does it do? Brainstem is breathing. Your breathing center, the medulla. In other words, we're all breathing, even though we're not thinking about it, because our brainstems are operating. There are cells there that are very, very important that are having us breathe. What disease attacks those cells and stops the person from breathing? Begins with a P. Polio. Polio attacks the ability to, really doesn't attack those cells, it attacks other cells. But the reason I'm mentioning polio now is, if I told you that the definition of death in halacha is irreversible stoppage of breathing. So let's say you have something like polio, a person, lo alein or chol hatzlan, and they're not breathing, but they're conscious and talking because they're in an iron lung. That's what they used to do in the times of the polio epidemic. So they would take these people, they would put them in iron lungs. You know what iron lung is? It kind of puts the person in negative pressure, creates like a force to expand the chest. The person can't do it because he's got this polio disease which is knocking out all his muscles. Muscles are not able to contract. So instead, this machine does it for him. We gave those up and now we have positive pressure. What's the one advantage of the old style negative pressure iron lung? Person could talk. Right? So you had all these polio people, low later on, in these iron lungs, speaking to you, hi, how you doing? Who, according to the definition of some people, are dead. That's pretty strange, at best. Right? So of course we're gonna have to get a greater modification. It can't be just breathing, right? But that is the single most important thing the brainstem does. What else does it do? It also is involved in regulating your heart rate and your blood pressure, and it's involved in the cranial nerves. Anyone know what the cranial nerves are? Cranial nerves are nerves that are coming out of your brainstem, and they do certain reflexes that when a neurologist wants to see, and you probably in the movies and on TV. You've seen when they want to say, is the guy dead? So what do? They check, sometimes they'll check the pulse and they'll say, oh, he has no pulse. Right? But what if he does have a pulse? They want to say he's dead. But then what do they do?
Poke his toes.
So they look for the cranial reflexes. What's the most famous? Pupils are fixed and dilated. What does that mean, pupils are fixed and dilated? That means, what are your pupils in the black of your eye? No, I should say your. One, a dead person's pupils will be fixed and dilated. They'll be dilated, big, open. Fixed means when I put light on them, they won't constrict. The normal thing is when I put light on all of us, our pupils constrict. Why?
Well,
I want to let less light in, right? Because I don't need that much light on my retina to see. Right? If I'm in a dark room, my pupils widen. If I'm in light, they constrict. But if a person's cranial nerve is not working, because it's a cranial nerve that does that, right? If the cranial nerves are not operating, then that won't be. They'll be fixed and dilated. One of the other cranial nerves is not really that important to you, but you should know that all the cranial nerves need to be out to declare someone brain dead. Right? They don't fool around. They take it seriously. So that means that they won't have a gag reflex, right? Anyone ever have a doctor stick a tongue blade down their throat and gag? That's because of a cranial nerve. And Baruch Hashem, you gag. If you don't gag, then you got to start to worry a little, alright? Because that means something's funny, right? It's better to gag than not to gag. And there are various other ones. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody's eyes do the nystagmus, like move very fast, or move from side to side very fast. You've probably not seen it. Anyone who's going to medical school will, right? So there's certain diseases that cause that. And then if I put cold water in your ear, and if I have a volunteer, I'll be happy to demonstrate for everybody. You put cold water into your ear, right outside. It's called cold calorics. We can watch your eyes do nystagmus. Anyone want to try? Nah, don't do it. That's another test they're going to do at the bedside. They want to make sure that cranial nerve, it's the eighth nerve, if you're interested in which one it is, right? I'm sure you are. One day you're going to have to know them all by heart. You can make up a mnemonic, whoever's pre-med, and good luck. But you all got to do it. What? There are 12. That's it, right? They all have various functions, and it's no big deal. Right? Okay. So
that's only like the
that's the brainstem. Basically, cranial nerves and breathing, right? Supercortex were all those other things I told you. So now, in the year 2011, for someone to be absolutely declared dead in any hospital, turn to page 6 and page 7. Here's what happens. Oh, I'm sorry. Before you turn those pages, there's one other little detail that I want you to know. This was the problem I ran into. I told you that story about first they were going with Rabbi Tender, and then they switched to the Rabbanut. So here's what's relevant to that. I want you to see the blood supply. You see the brain on page 5 on the bottom? There are those arteries, those critical arteries going up to the brain. You see how that goes up, and then there's a whole network in the brain, right? So the assumption is that when someone's brain dead, the blood stops flowing at the neck, and no blood's going up to the brain, okay? And that could be like a form of decapitation, and this is going to be very important halachically, right? If we see the brain is disconnected from the body, there's no circulating blood from the body to the brain, that might be enough, according to some, to say there is now a decapitation of the head, right? A physiologic decapitation, which might fit with a certain Mishnah that we're going to get to. All right, so now turn the page. Page 6 gives you a table of exactly what's required according to the Presidential Harvard Committee's criteria, right? Basically, there are two ways, what we call the traditional definition of death. The traditional definition is cardiopulmonary, which means you have to show irreversibly that there is no breathing, and irreversibly there is no circulation, no heartbeats, and no breathing. That's the old-fashioned way, the good old-fashioned way. Is there anyone, that's a horrible way to speak, is there anyone in the world, any posek, any shita, that does not recognize A as a viable halachic determination of death? Answer, no. Chuliyama. Everyone agrees to this. If you have that, that's the good old-fashioned way of saying somebody's dead. And that counts the Chuliyama Lisafir.
Why don't you need the first definition?
If you have the second?
Yeah.
Well, we need it because, I need it because I don't buy the second. Right? But the reason you need it is, let's say, out in the field, this is what typically happens, and somebody's not being resuscitated and they want to declare them dead, and that happens sometimes.
Oh, they don't have to do the whole brain thing.
They don't have to have a whole brain death thing, because if you got this, you don't need brain. The brain's certainly dead if this is all dead. Although there is one posek, I just simplified things, I'm sorry. I left out one very important posek who's very machmir on this issue, near and dear to all our hearts, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is the yachid who actually says, in order to declare someone dead, al pi din, you need heart, breathing, and brain, all three. So he probably would say you would have to somehow show even me. But he is a das yachid in this area. He's a dosya. Really, no one else is asking for that. It's very interesting that the Torah, the lumdus, how he developed that, I'm going to share with you, because that's very interesting. Much more interesting than the science, if you ask me.
He's the only one that holds all three?
Yeah. Wow. It's interesting how he develops it. You'll see. I'm going to do it with you. It's very interesting. We'll get into the sugyas, and you'll see that his is very brisk. It's very interesting.
It's a lot more acceptable for a Jew to sign a DNR if after there's no pulse anymore. We can assume that that person is...
It's interesting that you should say it that way. You know, the Sicily Ezra is a fantastic or fascinating tshuva. But he asked that shayla, right? And he asked the following shayla. I think this is what you're asking. Once somebody, let's say, has no circulation and not breathing, I assume, is it mutter up your dead to sign a DNR? So what's wrong with that question? And you're a good company. I'm not making fun of you because the Tzitzel Yezer said the same thing. And everybody's like saying, what? Because what does it mean to sign a DNR when someone's dead? If they have no circulation, that's what I just, that was the point I was just making. If there's no circulation and there's no breathing, it's too late for a DNR.
No, I'm saying the person has a DNR.
Is it acceptable for...
Do not resuscitate. Means that you can't intervene on the person.
Right.
But what do you mean to say?
Is it acceptable for a Jew to have a DNR?
Oh, yeah.
It's
well.
Possible, very... Meaning two things. First of all, when someone doesn't have pulse, even if you don't feel carotid, and let's say there are no medics on scene that can define with an EKG whether the person has any pulse whatsoever, theoretically there might be something that CPR, an AED, that would bring back, but it's a DNR, so none of those measurements are required. But theoretically, it could still be resuscitated. Therefore, that's...
I'll answer your question, even though... I misunderstood you before. I'll answer your question. Your question really is a whole other topic that we're going to do next, even though I was going to do it last, but we might as well do it next to this one. It relates to this one. It's a whole other topic. It's called end-of-life decisions, right? And that's a very serious, unfortunately, everyone in this room will encounter it sometime. I mean, hopefully Mashiach will come and death will end. It won't be like the Rambam Pshita or whatever, and whatever. But... in my experience, everybody goes through a point where they, you know, for a family member, for somebody, they're involved in an end-of-life decision where that child comes up. I have encountered it 1,000 times in my life. Right? We're going to do a whole topic on it. It's a big, big topic. What the answer to your, the short answer to your question is it depends on the setting and it depends on the posek. I'm going to show you basically 6 or 7 shitos, right, on this issue. I'll make it easier than that. We'll kind of put some together and break up. But sometimes yes, sometimes no. In other words, if I'll give you just the quick example to really give you a satisfying answer, if it's a, let's say a young healthy person who's never had anything, who's not, and this is a shayla pikuach nefesh, and it's not a shayla of prolonging someone's suffering, I would say 100% you're chayav to do everything you possibly can until the person's dead. You must do CPR. You must do everything. No DNRs. If it's a person who's racked with cancer, lo aleinu, suffering tremendously, while I will show you poskim that even in this setting, they will usher the DNR, I'll show you that most, now begin to have room for DNR. DNR comes in many flavors. There's a DNR not to do anything, right, which is maybe what you're thinking. And then there's DNR, don't do CPR, which is a very gruesome thing if you've ever seen it. You probably haven't seen it. I've been through many of them. It is not a pleasant experience for anyone, particularly the patient, and even the successful DNR resuscitations. Right? It's a lot of suffering and a lot of pain and a lot of mess. And so you have to realize: am I prolonging someone's suffering? There's no chiyuv to do that. And we'll see how this all works out. Pitin. There's many gemaras that support. And then again, it'll depend on the setting. But we'll go through all the details after we finish this topic. But getting back to this, I wanted you to see page 7 is my favorite page. Here's where you see what's going to be very important for the Rabbanut of Eretz Yisrael. Bottom line on how a person is declared brain dead is step 1. See what is the guy doing on the front, the top? What's he doing to that guy? He's pitching his head. Why is he doing that? Remember what I tell you is, remember, always think cerebral cortex, brainstem. Cerebral cortex is consciousness. Is the person awake? Is he reactive? Does he feel? So that's what he's doing. That's pain stimuli. You can either use 8 times needles, or you can just pinch. Right? That's what neurologists will typically do. Step 1 is his cerebral cortex intact? He is using a needle. See his hand near the hand? Right? So he's using pain stimuli over there. Right? In order to declare somebody dead, brain dead, you must show there is no response to pain. right? No response to sound for sure, but even go further than that, no response at all to pain. Okay, good. Then, that's the end of the supracortex. If the person's not reacting at all to anything, you've taken care of that. What's left? Brainstem. What are the two things I told you the brainstem does? Cranial nerves and breathing. So in the middle there, you see that little diagram going through a lot of the cranial nerve reflexes that we talked about. Great. All of those are in there. Then comes number three, and this is the single most important part of the whole thing. According to the Rabbanut of Eretz Yisrael, this is all you got to do. Right? I mean, they do the first two, but they say it really all comes down to this, number three. Number three is the apnea test. What does the word apnea mean? Right. Stoppage, cessation of breathing. Apnea. The person's not breathing. How do I tell if someone's breathing? Right? This might be more or less medical detail than you want to know, but what the heck, right? What stimulates us to breathe? Why do we breathe? Our brainstems breathe. What makes our brainstem make us breathe? What'd you say? No. Yes.
What is it?
Right? Carbon dioxide. What's involved in breathing? I breathe in oxygen. I breathe out carbon dioxide. Why am I breathing out carbon dioxide? Because what am I doing with the oxygen I breathe in? It's going to my cells, and the cells in my body are using it. Right? Remember all that good old stuff? Yeah, they made you take ATP, all that kind of thing. Right? So you got to learn it. Right? Get good luck next year, whoever's free man. You'll learn all about the Krebs cycle, all this great stuff.
I wish we stopped having calories.
Bottom line is, though, what happens is you take in the oxygen, your body uses the oxygen, and it starts to secrete and produce carbon dioxide, CO2. And that builds up in the blood. That's the stimulus for breathing. Because the body, the brain, senses the CO2 going up, it breathes. So it keeps your CO2 around 40, just to give you a number, right? Somewhere between 30 and 40, right? That would be typical. What happens if you hyperventilate, you breathe too much? Too fast, like you're nervous? This is a very typical panic attack. I'm about to describe anyone about a panic attack, you don't have to tell us. But many people have panic attacks, many Ashkenazi Jews, right? Very prevalent in Ashkenazi Jewish community. And what a panic attack basically is, they start to feel like they're tingling all over, and they're going crazy, they're losing their mind, all these kind of feelings, and they're convinced they're dying, right? Why? Mainly because they're hyperventilating. When you hyperventilate, if I tell you, breathing out gets rid of CO2, so breathing out a lot will make your CO2 very low. A low CO2 makes you sort of alkalotic, as opposed to acidic, and the alkalosis of the body is what gives you all those funny feelings. Why am I going to the trouble of telling you all this? You don't need to know this for the Torah here, but I always tell this to people when I'm talking about this, because sometimes it helps you deal with a panic attack if you're a person who's having it, to know that there's an explanation for what's happening to you. Relax, and as soon as you relax, you'll go away. Just stop hyperventilating. Alright. Now, one more scientific fact, and I promise you, Torah till the end. Okay? One more scientific fact, that's page 8. That's the last bit of scientific information you need. This is the famous Rabbi Tendler joke. Okay? Rabbi Tendler loves to use the line, or he used to, but we'll see, that, remember I told you now, he's going to want, as part of his declaring brain dead, he threw in one extra thing that's not normally done. Everything up till now is what's always done. But Rabbi Tendler wanted something else to show the no blood flow to the head. So how did he recommend doing it? Right? What's the problem with, let's say, if I told you the gold standard, this is a halakhic issue, I want to see who knows this. If I told you the gold standard for telling whether there's blood flow to the brain is an angiogram, which means you inject dye into the body, and then you see, does the dye in the bloodstream go up to the head? That's the gold standard. But we would never do that in this setting. Why?
Not necessarily.
Also, the blood might not be pumping.
Anyone ever hear the expression, gosase?
Because a person's on brain,
they're dying. Right. If a person's not dead, then they're...
They're about to be dead.
They're a gosase, which is about to be dead. And what's the din by a gosase? They're very fragile. You know what the Gemara compares a gosase to? A flickering candle. You just touch it and it's gone, right? You usher to touch a gosase. This is going to be very important for anyone who's ever near a dead body, lo aleinu. But if you are any of you going to be doctors, you should be aware of this. I'll tell you a story. I guess we'll kind of end with this, and then we'll, starting on Thursday, we'll have all Torah, which is one of my first experiences as a medical student. Was I'm on medicine and I go in, the resident's calling for me. When the residents call for you, it's trouble, right? It's never to be a good teacher and teach you something. It's they need you, right? For something they don't want to do. So what's going on? There's a guy in the room, Molino, dying. The pancreatic cancer is like a dosis munch. She doesn't know, she's panicking, the resident. She's absolutely in a panic. And she calls me and she wants me, right? She's not sure, maybe he's dead, maybe he's not. She wants me to do the EKG, to do an EKG and get a flatline EKG to show that his heart's not beating. And I'm telling her, no, I can't do that. He's a ghostess. I'm not telling her that because she was like, I think from the Dominican Republic. I don't know what she was. She wasn't Jewish. She wouldn't know what I'm talking about. Even if she was Jewish, she probably wouldn't know what I'm talking about. But you cannot touch a ghostess, no matter what your resident tells you. So she was inappropriate for telling me to do that. Here I am, medical student. Like, first day on the clerkship, I had no exposure. All I did was textbooks up until then. My first day, she's throwing me in to do that. It was very inappropriate of her. Nevertheless, you are not obligated ever to do something that's usser, right? And certainly not an act of ritzicha, by the way, which this would be. If you do something to kill a goses, that is an act of ritzicha. That's pretty serious. So I always also want you guys to know that, whoever's going to be going to medicine. Don't play around with those kind of things. No one can force you to do something like that. All right. So that's why we don't do angiograms. If you started to try to do an angiogram on someone who's a ghostist, you would kill them. So Rav Temler could never have suggested do that. Instead, he thought he came up with a solution. Something called a radionuclide study. That's what you have on page 8. And what that is it's less, far less aggressive than an angiogram. All it needs is a little IV, and then you just gently, he said, inject into the IV radionuclide tagged cells. And then it gives you pictures like this, or what he calls the hole in the head, right? Positive sign is if there's a hole in the head, that means the brain is not getting any circulation and the person's physiologically decapitated, right? You see that? See these pictures on top? That's timeline, right? The flow comes in, the flow is full. By frame number 30, all the flow is in, but there's a big empty spot. See that? Right in the middle. So, according to Rav Tenda, originally, this was necessary. This was the thing I was telling you Columbia did not do. They do not do this. And that's why I couldn't declare them dead according to Rav Tenda's criteria. Right? Incidentally, I want you to know, Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Eliyashiv, part of the problem they had with the whole Rav Tenda approach was they think this is even usher to do to a ghostess. If the Torah tells me, right, if the Gemara tells me, Chazal tell me, I'm not even allowed to remove keys that might be under the pillow of a ghostess, or put keys under the pillow of a ghostess that might need them a little bit, or touch a little thing and they're like a flickering candle, they said, pshita, that I can't start injecting things into their veins. So one of the catch-22s that really obviated the possibility, and we're going to see, we're going to originally hear about doing this imaging study as part of the halachic approach, it's going to be eliminated because you can't do it. You just can't do it. Because you're dealing always with the Gosei, so that's why the post-scheme of Eretz Yisrael, not the Rabbanut, but the Gedolei Yisrael, right? Ooh, that was a little politically incorrect, sorry. They would never allow any of this kind of extra testing. If there's going to be a halachic declaration of death, it's going to have to flow with the out-touching parts, which is the apnea test, which I didn't tell you how it goes, but it doesn't involve anything too invasive, and the rest of it. All right. So I promise you, that's it for the scientific background that we need. As things come up, I might refer to it again. But starting on Thursday, what you'll see is we're going to go be'ion. And I suggest everybody, if you have time, it's a little tiny sugya. Look at the sugya on page 9, right? There's a Mishnah and a Gemara, very little. This is supposedly the main source for the Rabbanut's psak. And then on page 10 is a Mishnah from Olos and a Gemara from Chulin. That's the other source material. That's it. If you're Bucky in these Makoros, you're as much an expert as anyone out there on the psak for determining the time of
life. If you're with a patient that is in that tenuous state and you're holding their hand, are you considered to be doing something?
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. I'll tell you the kind of cheshbon you can make. You can make the final cheshbon. Sometimes holding the hand does more good for them than bad for them. Meaning, like, If the person is going to be psychologically improved and emotionally improved,
but if you have no way of knowing if
they're not calm. Yeah, so yeah, then you best not to touch. Right? There are exceptions that I have made with people. Let's say lo aleinu with a kid. You know, as I start thinking about this, I'm going to stop crying. But like I've been in that situation with a kid, and the kid is scared out of their mind, and they need to be helped. And I think that the agony and the emotional, psychological agony of being left alone is more of a trauma to the Gosses than holding his hand. So for sure, in that setting, when it can be determined that way, which I think it could, motor. But if it's a person who's like not responsive, comatose, then if it's possible there are Gosses, he shouldn't be touching him. Because it's a very serious other. You know, to end the life of a Gosses prematurely is as much an act of Ritzicha as shooting somebody, you know, point blank in the hand. It's the same thing. A very serious
error. But if you did this and you found that he was still alive in front of the offenders, then you put him on a respirator or something like that.
So that's right. When we talk about some of the other questions about end of life decisions, we're going to see, you know, there comes a point where you have to check. So you have to take someone off, right? And how the post can tell you to do it would be eye-opening. Because they have, there's a derech. Rav Moshe has one derech, Rav Shlomo Zalman has another derech, on how they tell you to handle those kind of situations. We will discuss that actually in detail. Alright, so again, let's try, if you guys can get some background in the sugya, it'll go much smoother. It's going to be ma'ayin, tell me, when you do the Gemara in Yuma, do you think it's defining death a particular way? If you talk to the Rabbanut of Eretz Yisrael, they swear it definitely is. Thank you.